Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Mohamed Idris Ahmad, who is a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He is a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts and co-edits pulsemedia.org and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohamed Idris Ahmad.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And let's start with what's happening in Syria, or at least what we perhaps may be happening here. It's been pretty clear from the outset, in spite of a lot of what the political left have been saying about the U.S. Wanting to intervene in Syria as they did in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's been pretty clear that there's been a lot of ambivalence on the American side, that in fact the West in general knows what it doesn't want in Syria, but doesn't know what it really wants, whereas the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians know exactly what they want. And so far they've got what they want, and they're effectively winning, if anybody's winning in a situation where a country's being destroyed so that a dictator can maintain this kind of plantation control over this country that his family's had for 40 or 50 years. So there are indications that the U.S. may be stepping up activities with Jordan, carving out a kind of zone there around Daraa on the border where the original uprising against Assad began. So do you think the Obama administration is having second thoughts?
Well, I think you summarized it very well. I mean, what's happening is that after 3 years, Obama administration has realized that its policy has been a disaster. And for the Syrians, especially, it's been a massive disaster. And what it has ended up with is that the major centers of resistance, especially in Homs and then also in Aleppo, so there the regime is gaining. And in fact, in Homs, it has been very much been able to reestablish its control. So what's happening in under those circumstances is that the Obama administration, which was not, as you pointed out, that which never knew what it wanted, but at the same time, the other side, the Russians and the Chinese, as well as the Iranians, so they are pretty certain about what the outcome that they want to see. So they back the regime fully. And the regime has military superiority, and it has been regaining control. And outcome of that is that right now, nearly 9 million people are displaced. And a lot of the people who are inside, they're internally displaced, and they're facing starvation. There are sieges going on. And as a result, these people have absolutely no hope at the moment. And it's not being helped that at the same time, the Obama administration's commitment has always been to arm just barely enough so that they can resist. They can resist a complete takeover by the Assad regime, but not enough to grant the opposition victory because they have other concerns. They were very reluctant to give anti-aircraft weaponry because they were concerned that they might be turning on their ally Israel should it use its air force over Syria in the future. So these concerns, what they have made is that they've created a very paranoid policy, a sort of a schizophrenic policy. And in the end, it's not really helping that this policy is going to... It certainly isn't benefiting any party on the which is on the receiving end of the Assad regime's repression. So they are barely holding on, and the position is quite weak at the moment. And whatever aid that is being received even now, it's so minimal that it's not sufficient to turn the tide. So the absolute minimum is being done, and that's certainly not helping.
But what has happened is that Syria has become a magnet for jihadis who flocked in, often with the encouragement of Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, although now Saudi Arabia and Qatar are at odds over policies vis-a-vis Syria. And that's apparently...
Yeah, there is a misconception about that, that the jihadis who have come... on Turkish side, there was a certain degree of tolerance for foreign fighters who were coming in. But as regards the jihadis, they have their own networks. And so they are not reliant on any state. In fact, both the Saudis as well as the Turks have an interest not in encouraging any kind of jihadism because for them, the blowback can be more immediate, and especially the Saudis. But these people have their own networks, they have their own funding networks, and they also have their supply networks. So they are not really reliant on state so much as these networks of private donors across the Gulf mainly.
But what they have achieved is they've been a massive boon for Assad. They have,
of course,
driven so much of the population that were ambivalent into the embrace of Assad because they're afraid of these people, and quite understandably so. They've discredited the rebel movement in general and led people to make excuses for Assad.
Well, that's very, very true. What has happened is that there was a vacuum left because the nationalist opposition, so there was a resistance movement, and they had sort of come under the umbrella of the FSA, which was not exactly a single hierarchical organization, but it was a coalition
and,
of various...
And that's the Free Syrian Army, FSA.
Yes. Yeah. So what happened is that they were starved of weapons. So, in fact, the main U.S. involvement there was that the CIA was stationed in southern Turkey to vet who the weapons that people were receiving from Qatar or Saudi Arabia, that who they might end up with, and which excluded a very large number of, in fact, the most effective groups within the FSA. So, in the end, starved for weapons, they were not winning, and people usually support the winning side. And what has happened is that people started then flocking to the two main Islamist, the jihadist groups. One is the Jabhat al-Nusra, and the other one is the more extreme ISIS. And what has happened right now is the ISIS, which is more independent, and it's mainly foreign fighters, foreign jihadists. So they are the ones who have benefited most. And yes, there has almost been a tacit agreement with the regime. The regime very rarely attacks ISIS camps or their positions. And similarly, ISIS has been mainly fighting not the regime, but other rebel groups. And the territory that rebel groups liberate, so they soon after then the ISIS steps in, and then they try to take control, and then they try to impose their own hardline laws over there.
So, again, I'm speaking with Mohammed Idris Ahmad, who's a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He's a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, co-edits pulsemedia.org, and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism. So let's get into that subject matter. Your article, of course, is about how Seymour Hersh is, in the London Review of Books, is still insisting that the chemical attack that took place a couple of years ago that led to this deal between the United States and Russia and Syria to get rid of Syria's chemical arsenal, which has largely been done, in my understanding. Whoever instigated that incident has been a matter of debate, but it's been pretty clear that it was from day one the Assad regime. What is the evidence that Tsai insists that he still has?
Well, his evidence is quite dubious because he only uses unnamed secret sources, and in this case, the story that he's retailing has been on the internet for quite some time. It was a conspiracy theory that started off on a Canadian conspiracy site called Global Research, and
that's that fellow with the Russian sounding name. That
yes, Michel Chusadovsky.
Yeah, he's a conspiracy theorist, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a pretty ludicrous. In fact, if you look at the original article from which the story was plagiarized, it's called. Not Cy Hirsch's story. He didn't plagiarize it, but his source, because there's a group of former intelligence and officers and diplomats who had plagiarized that story and published it as an open letter to Obama. But if you look at the original source, the headline of the article by a fellow called Joseph Bodansky is that was the White House behind the chemical attack in Syria? And its conclusion is yes, of course. And so the thing is that it was a pretty ludicrous theory, which was started off at, on which began at this conspiracy site, from which it was picked up by this group of former intelligence officials.
Is that the VIPS?
VIPS. And what they did is that in the article, they claim that they have got all these sources in the Middle East who have told them this, except even that line itself in which they claim they have sources was also plagiarized from the original article. So if you read my article, you can see the plagiarized quotes from both of them, that how even down to the ellipses, they are in the exact places. So what happened is that story had been on the internet for quite some time. And Cy Hirsch first published a story in which he claimed that the Obama administration knew that the rebels were capable of producing sarin. And for that reason, he said that the Obama administration should have not laid the blame exclusively on the regime, but should have also considered blaming the rebels. Well, I mean, it was a very hedged argument, and fair enough, if there was such an evidence, except the evidence that he presents is just one news report that has once appeared that some rebel groups had tried to acquire some chemicals in Turkey. They were caught. But the initial story went around saying that they were trying to acquire sarin, except when what the evidence was looked at, it was just a list of rather everyday chemicals that these people were after. So it was a non-story, but he took it, and somebody has then spun something really big for him, his source, and he comes out with then a subsequent article. I mean, we won't be talking about this if it wasn't the name of Seymour Hersh and the London Review of Books, you know, both respectable names. So he comes out with then this really absurd conspiracy theory that the Turkish prime minister was personally involved in this attack, that he himself orchestrated it, and that these rebels, they somehow, I mean, he doesn't explain how, but they managed to take 1 ton of sarin into a besieged zone, I mean, a zone that is under the control of the government, and somehow even managed to rig a delivery mechanism, and somehow even managed to fire them in such a way that they appear to be coming from the regime-held areas. So the practicalities he doesn't go into. He just sends a nice conspiracy theory and says that the rebels could have done this, and his secret source told him that. And his secret source also told him that Erdogan, the Turkish prime minister, was personally involved. And in between, the practicalities are completely left out. So what I try to do with my article is to point out that how, in every respect, from the practicality, from the logic to the evidence, all of the Seymour Hersh's article is bunk. So it lit the conspiracy sphere on fire, but it has absolutely no substance. And yet, what it did is that it enabled the regime to continue, because people are reluctant. They think that somehow that story is it's still in that the jury is somehow still out on that story, that we still don't know who did it, except we do. But according to Hirsch, we don't. And people have taken comfort. There is this psychological comfort in not knowing. And because of that, they are unwilling to assign blame when new violations occur. The regime's atrocities are ongoing, and yet people are reluctant to blame because they think that somehow it's all in dispute.
Well, but the real story is so much at odds with that. I mean, I understand why a lot of people feel badly burned by Iraq in particular, not so much Afghanistan, but certainly Iraq, in the sense that the Bush administration lied their way into this war and conned everybody and trumped up a whole bunch of phony reasons for war and manufactured, the uranium hoax in Niger and all that stuff that Colin Powell addressed the UN with. So it's not, and I mean, the problem with conspiracy theorists is that they always, in the real world, intentions determine outcomes. Outcomes don't determine intentions. But if you take the latter and go to the outcome and then just trace back, you can make up the intention. You know, because the 9/11 tragedy led to Bush going to war, the assumption is that Bush arranged for that tragedy in order to go to war. And that's become the new groupthink on elements of the left, not the entire political left since then. And so you can understand that. But in the real world, my understanding is that Obama's been incredibly reluctant from day one to get involved, that Hillary Clinton, Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, and David Petraeus really leaned on him to arm the rebels, which he didn't do. And that what's really been going on is that Obama has a very close relationship with Putin, which is a big surprise to many people, that they talk regularly and often, and that Obama's focus is on the pivot to Russia and maintaining that relationship is because it's far more important than some murderous little plantation owner in Syria. And that's what's really been governing it all. And, you know,
Well, I think, first, the thing is that there's a comfort in conspiracy theories because to know what happens in governments, it takes effort. And the day-to-day activities of governance and all of these things, they, in order to stay abreast of them, you have to put in a lot of time. And people take comfort in conspiracy theories because it explains the world without a person having to do any actual intellectual investment. And what has happened in the case of, for example, Iraq, I wrote a whole book about the Iraq War, so I know that's what kind of deceptions were used and what an unprovoked war it was. But that in no way, because I spent a lot of time trying to understand how this came about and how, when especially the government was so reluctant, so many parts of the government were so reluctant that this war came about. Whereas in this case, the story is completely different because in Iraq, there was no urgency to the situation. That's why the whole pretext had to be manufactured. I mean, Saddam Hussein wasn't out on a rampage at that time. His worst crimes were behind him by more than a decade. And nobody was even claiming that he's engaged in any kind of massacres or slaughters at that particular time. In fact, he was very much confined. Most of the deaths were indeed occurring because of the UN sanctions at the time. And then what we had, just simply the fact that the pretext then had to be invented. So it became the weapons of mass destruction and the conjunction with the involvement with terrorists, that if Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and if it hands them over to a terrorist, so they might do something. And that is an imminent threat. That's how the whole thing was sold. But the humanitarian pretexts were not even used until much after. But in Syria, we know day to day, I mean, not just from the U.S. government, but from a whole range of sources, independent sources, we know that atrocities are being committed daily. And that's something nobody disputes. So there is an urgency to the situation. So this is nothing like Iraq. And secondly, as you point out, that the U.S. has been anything but eager to go and intervene. In fact, even in Libya, If you remember, Obama was never gung-ho about it. In fact, he was dragged in with a lot of pressure from the British and the French governments. So same thing is true of Syria, because in Syria, U.S. doesn't have any interest at stake. So that's why there's a reluctance to commit troops. And that has, I mean, and also we know that Obama has generally been very reluctant to commit troops. I mean, the only first major escalation that he did in Afghanistan, we know the story of that because of Bob Woodward's work, that it came out of a great deal of pressure from the army, from Petraeus and others. But again, that was a temporary concession. But now what has happened is since then, he has been reluctant to commit any new troops. He's afraid of the political consequences at home, and especially in a place like Syria where there's no interest at stake. So why would he commit troops? So there was never an actual threat of a U.S. intervention. But that became a red herring for the political left because what they used is that instead of worrying about the actual atrocities that are going on over there, they deflected attention. They made it the whole debate about this imminent threat of a U.S. invasion, which was actually never really being seriously considered. There was a very brief moment last September when it looked like the U.S. might do something, but that came and went. And yet, this whole obsession with a supposed U.S. intervention has remained, and that has taken attention away from the actual atrocities that are happening day to day, and the perpetrator is well known. It's the Syrian regime.
Well, Mohammed Idris Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Idris Ahmed, who is a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He is a lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, co-edits pulsemedia.org, and is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. His latest article at the LA Review of Books is A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Chinese government's official amnesia over the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre.